Welcome to the Tech Policy Podcast. I'm Evan Schwartzdraber. On today's show, Cuba's Digital Future, Part 2. You may have heard an episode we did a very long time ago about where Cuba was heading and what the future was for technology and the internet. And now we've had an election and we've had a potential change in policy. And we're going to talk about that with three amazing guests. Celia Mendoza, founder of Concierge Havana, an agency that does itineraries for Americans coming to Cuba, all sorts of things like accommodation and transportation. Celia, thanks for joining.
Thank you so much.
And Robin Pedraja, founder, CEO, and creative director of VStar, the first independent magazine in Cuba focusing on culture and entertainment. Robin, thanks for joining.
Hi.
And friend of the show, Michael Mizell. I forgot your title. This always happens when I'm like really friendly with someone. I just forget their titles. You want to tell everyone what your title is, Michael?
Director of External Affairs.
There you go. All right. Next time I'll do some basic research before doing a podcast, if the listeners will forgive this mistake. But I'll just mention before we jump in that when I last did a podcast on the show, I had not been to Cuba. So I knew that I had my views on the situation and I felt very strongly about certain things when it came to technology and the embargo, but now I've gone down. Thanks to Michael at Engage Cuba, Tech Freedom's a member of that coalition, and others who helped organize the trip. I learned a lot in just the 5 or 6 days that I was there, and it was truly an incredible experience. And I'm excited and fortunate to be able to talk about it with you and these incredible entrepreneurs who've made it all the way to D.C. So just to start, Robin, why are you in D.C.? What brought you here?
The reason that I'm here is I came with a group of friends that we are mostly entrepreneurs. We want to talk with people and try to sensibilize, to make the dialogue to roll back the advance that the U.S. made from Cuba since 2014. This is basically what we want to do. We as entrepreneurs, we want to keep our good relationship with United States of America. And that's why.
And Celia, I understand that on this trip, you are actually meeting with U.S. government officials. I'm not sure if you've already done that. This might be early on in your trip, but if you have done that, how is that going? But if not, what do you hope to accomplish when you meet with these representatives in Congress?
Well, just before we came to the podcast, we had an incredible meeting with some congressmen. There were some Republicans on board there, which was great because they were able to hear for the first time about the existence of a private sector in Cuba, about how after 2014 and the opening of Cuba and the United States, how our businesses have improved a great amount due to this opening. And we have during this week more meetings. And in these meetings, our objectives are to express how thankful we are and how successful our businesses have become thanks to this opening, thanks to the American visitors that are visiting the island. And we don't want the measures that have been taking place so far to go back, because this will deeply affect the private sector of Cuba. And when we say private sector, we're saying about a half of the population of the whole island that is right now or thinking about enrolling into the private sector and opening their own business.
Yeah, and that's 11 million people. And just to bring listeners up to speed, what we're talking about here is in 2014, then President Obama opened up relations with Cuba. He did not lift the embargo because that would require an act from Congress, but he did do some things at the executive level, which allowed Americans to travel for educational purposes, for peer-to-peer engagement, which is kind of like that catch-all category, which has allowed for some of this wonderful exchange of value and ideas. Then we had an election, and folks like Senator Rubio have very strong feelings against the Castro regime, and they have the ear of President Trump. And on June 16th, after we had kind of gotten a hint that this was going to happen, President Trump announced that there would be changes. Now, over the next couple months, we will see what those changes are. The regulations are not finalized yet, but most signs point to at least some type of rollback. It's not going to be a total rollback. The embassy will remain open. Relations will remain open. But it's not going in the direction of engagement. It's going in the opposite direction. One of the really interesting things about Cuba right now is the internet situation down there is very unique. It's not like most countries in the world where internet is either there or it's not there, and it's kind of like a binary, or it's hard to get access, or it's slow or it's fast. It's a very unique situation. And in your business, how are you using the internet, given that we're talking maybe 3% of Cuban homes have a connection in the home? A third of Cubans have accessed the internet using these Wi-Fi hotspots, which are growing in number, but it's not the easiest. So how are you able to use the internet to benefit your business?
I would like to add that it's not the easiest, but it has not been impossible. Cuba has started a slow, but it has started a way into the progress of what is internet and given internet. Right now, we have 380 Wi-Fi spots in Cuba. Particularly in our case, this has benefited us a lot. Why? Because we were able to find an office that was close to one of these Wi-Fi points. This accelerated our businesses 100% because we used to be able to upload the magazine in a park. Every time I got an email from a client, I would go running to the park. And now we can do this from the office. And that means that I've been able to double my workers because I couldn't offer them before the conditions that you needed to have workers. But now I can have them with computers in an office and checking emails and back forth, and we were able to give them a faster response to clients, and we've been able to update our social media more, which is everybody knows how important is social media for a business. So that has been great, and this has attracted a whole lot of business to ourselves, and it's been good.
I've always been struck by how quickly Cubans seem to adapt to their circumstances, whether good or bad. And
we're known for
it
that.
Exactly. Right. And I saw it firsthand. And while it might have been a deliberate decision on the government's part to put these hotspots not in the home, to put them out in public where they can monitor who are using them, it just goes to show that you can't stifle technology. People will find a way. Now, Robin, I'm fascinated by your story because in the United States, there's a perception of Cuba as a communist regime, that there is no independent media, that people are not speaking freely about politics or culture or entertainment, and that all the media are controlled by the government. Yet here you are sitting across the table from me, and you are the founder and CEO and creative director of the first independent magazine. How are you getting away with this?
Yeah, it was very funny because 10 years ago, I was very involved in the audiovisual market. I used to do commercials, music videos. And then I work many times in commercials. And this is why came the idea to my mind to make the magazine, because I saw in Cuba too many independent business growing up, and they don't have advertisement, they don't do publicity. And because I knew how to make the advertisement, I just need to find a place to put the advertisement. No? And this is why I create Vistar. We are talking to young people, and we have a lot of readers. And at the very beginning, we don't know if this is going to be far, but now, 3 years later, we are here. The media is mostly controlled by the government, but at that time, I never thought about it. The government, they call us many times to cover the events, and not the government directly, but the entities who work for the government, like Minister of Culture.
So they found something useful in your business, even though when it first started, they might have been very concerned. How are people consuming your content? Is it do they have to log on to the internet using one of these hotspots, which can be expensive for the average Cuban? Or is there another way that they're able to consume this content? Because I'm assuming you don't print the magazine. It's all online.
Yeah, it's online. At the very beginning, we just put the magazine in the El Paquete de la Semana, who is a hard drive with a lot of information about everything they found on the internet. And for the Cubans overseas, you know, the Cuban living in Miami, Cuban living in Spain, Mexico, we just open a website where they can download the magazine for free, also with daily updates.
I mean, it's pretty incredible because there probably weren't that many opportunities for a business to be advertising before these entities. I mean, it was all word of mouth. I saw in Cuba myself that they now have promoters outside some of the bars and restaurants, which is a fun concept, human advertisers. But obviously the magazine is another way. Just to refresh our listeners' memories, we talked about this last time, but Michael, can you describe what is El Paquete?
So el paquete translates to the package, and it's basically a network of a distribution network of USB flash drives. There's a point person who downloads a ton of content, a lot of it from the US, House of Cards, you know, the Oscars, anything, and Vistar, which is Robin's magazine. And basically, you can subscribe to this paquete, and you choose as a Cuban consumer what you'd like to have included on whatever weekly content you get. So you kind of have a checklist, and you download that content, and it gets refreshed every week.
Yeah, and of course, for the American content and other foreign content, that actually requires some smuggling to happen. But for Robin's magazine, it's actually being produced in Cuba, so it's maybe a little bit less complicated to get on El Paquete. Getting back to the internet in Cuba, we heard two very different stories when we had some of these meetings. We met with people from the Cuban government who said, we'd love to connect the island. We'd love to. The only reason we aren't doing it is because we don't have the money. Okay, sounds fair, right? I mean, if the government does not have the resources to build the broadband themselves, that's a totally fair argument. We went to the U.S. Embassy. We asked the diplomat there, is the government telling us the situation straight? And he said, no, they could easily do more. They're worried about dissent. Do you guys talk about this, why you're not getting more internet? Do you have a sense of where broadband is going to be in a couple of years? I mean, we heard from so many entrepreneurs on our trip that that's what they need. They want more Wi-Fi. They want more connectivity to get be able to reach more customers. What is your sense of that disagreement there?
Well, unfortunately, maybe I'm not going to be able to satisfy the answer to your question, because neither I work for the Ministry of Communications or the Embassy of the United States. But in my opinion, is this is a process that if they were scared to open up, they wouldn't have even started. Now, you have certain elements that are very difficult when, in my personal opinion, that makes it harder. And one of those elements is the embargo. We have public knowledge that companies like Google have signed contracts with the Cuban government. And I don't think these things would have been happening if they're not going towards the way of opening. They've been doing research and testings in different houses in Old Havana. They're taking us, they're the test, the zeros, they're like the pilots. They're taking them to see how they can connect these houses, how slow it is, the rate, how much they would have to pay. And in my personal opinion, I think we're going towards development of communications in Cuba and not backwards, because it wouldn't make sense to open something, to start something and not finish it.
Right. So maybe it's just slower than people might like, but the overall trajectory is going to be positive.
Yes. I think the embargo has a lot of influence on how fast this is going to happen.
And is that something that you've discussed with American politicians, just how important it is that if you were to lift the embargo, more American companies could do business, there'd be more connectivity? Because it seems like American politicians, including the president, are very hung up on the regime and the military and just, are they getting money? Are we legitimizing them? Are we condoning their behavior? But this seems kind of separate. This is about economic development, about information, and not necessarily a tool for overthrowing the regime. I mean, when people talk about wanting more internet in Cuba, why do they want more internet? Is it for business, or is it so they can, you know, plan on the next revolution?
Okay. 3 years ago, when I start Vistar, like Celia say, I upload every month the magazine from the hotel, not even the park. So to the
they have Wi-Fi hotspots so in hotels
know,
too, right?
Yeah, the people know that at the very beginning that they put the hotspot, it was very only in the hotel. But 1 year later, we're talking about 2 years ago, they started to set up the hotspot on the streets and the public spaces. And right now we have many, many hotspots. So I want to say that in 3 years, we advanced a lot in the internet. More people gonna get new information. You people, I don't know, students can go online to make homeworks and stuff. Because in Cuba, right now in the school, the teachers, for example, they just teach based in the book or based in some papers.
The old information.
If they use the internet in the knowledge, they will learn a lot. And in 10 years, we will be more intelligent than right now.
Have either of you received any pushback from the Cuban government for what you're doing in the private sector? Because it seems like they're embracing the private sector because they know that there's so much potential for economic growth and that these are really the people who are driving Cuba towards the future. But at the same time, they have to be concerned about capitalism, about dissent, about free speech. So have you ever had a bad interaction or gotten a sense that people in the government are not thrilled with what you're doing?
No, never.
In my personal opinion, no. And in 2009, Raul authorized Cuenta Propistas. This is what we call the private sector in Cuba. This is what you call, it actually means, well, you could say,
it's like working on your own accord.
It's working on your own, self-employed. Exactly. That's the term. In Cuba, it's Cuenta Propista. Todos somos Cuenta Propistas. And we are Cuenta Propistas because in 2009, they authorized about 100 businesses that you could apply for a license and you can open your own business. And, 2 years ago, 2 days ago, sorry, Raul expressed in one of his speeches not to discriminate Cuenta Propistas because there might be some parts of some sectors of the government that still are, might be a little worried, might be like, what is going on?
The hardliners.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And now he said, do not discriminate them. We're going to support them. What we have to do is organize ourselves more. Let's help them organize. Let's allow them to become different entities and pay taxes the way that they're supposed to. One of my licenses is that I'm the middle person between the house owners and the clients. But they didn't think that I was going to organize so well. And I was going to build a website and I was going to have a brand. I was going to go to GoDaddy and buy a brand.
A domain.
They didn't think this part. So, and the more organized that we get, the more money we're making and the more successful our business are. So I think that they're just saying, we're not going to change this for the bad. We're going to change it for the good. But we're going to give you like the right tools for you to be able to become a company, a real company. So I say, in my personal opinion, this is the way it's going to.
So it sounds like both countries need to give a little and get a little, right? This is a two-part relationship, and it can't just be one-sided, even though us as Americans, as free marketeers, as capitalists, we might just be offended by the whole situation. But of course, if you go down there, I promise you that you won't feel that way. But earlier you said if the U.S. were to lift the embargo, the government would deploy broadband faster. What do you think the Cuban government could do to help convince the United States that it's worth lifting the embargo?
That's a good question.
That's why I asked, right?
Yes, it's a good question. What can the Cuban government do to... Well, I think the Cuban government, first, in my opinion, it doesn't have to do anything at all. We don't have to do anything to convince other countries of anything, just the same way United States doesn't have to do anything to convince us. I would think that we just have to continue the path we're going through, that we're sitting down, we're talking about bilateral themes that concern both countries and keep going this road of engagement and keep the embassy was a big important step. It's not United States didn't just open an embassy in Cuba. No, we established diplomatic relationships. That means that both countries agreed to be able to have diplomatic relationships again. And I think my opinion is just to continue this road of engagement towards the future, that both countries decide to come to a term where everybody is comfortable.
And Michael, you're kind of caught in the middle here a little bit because you spend a lot of time in Cuba and a lot of time in the United States, and you are American, as your accent might suggest, but you also speak Spanish fluently, as I've heard. How do you see it? I mean, you've dealt with both governments. You've dealt with American politicians and Cuban politicians. Just give us kind of your conclusion on the situation right now.
So the first thing that I wanted to actually jump in and say earlier is that I actually think it's too simplistic to say what could the U.S. government do, because as we've seen in a lot of what Engage Cuba's work has illustrated is that the U.S. government is not a monolithic entity, just right. Like the Cuban government isn't.
Right.
There are factions within both governments that maybe tend to be more conservative or hardline and those that are pushing for reform. So that's the first point. And then the second is that within the U.S. government, there is the difference of the powers that be, the administration, the executive branch, I should say, and Congress. And what we had been working on a lot during the Obama administration was pushing Congress and getting more members of Congress on board because that's where the embargo is actually codified. So there's a new administration with a more hostile rhetoric toward Cuba, and that's why it's important to get these entrepreneurs here in Washington to give their perspectives on a changing Cuba, a new Cuba, one that's allowing for private sector growth, and that in turn is, I would say, pushing the Cuban government, which again is not monolithic, but enabling those reformers within the government that want to see this change. Historically, the more that the U.S. has promoted a hostile rhetoric toward Cuba, the more that the hardliners within Cuba have succeeded.
Right. And of course, yeah, like when the government feels under threat, either our government or the Cuban government, there's going to be the door will close more than it could otherwise remain open. Michael, you've done a lot of these trips, not just with these fine entrepreneurs, but others in the past. And I met with some of them a couple years ago. What is the response generally? I mean, I could see kind of three groups. There's the indifferent politicians who might just defer to whoever is the loudest voice on the issue, like a Rubio. Then there are those who genuinely, truly support ending the embargo, like Jeff Flake, and from Senator from Arizona. And then you've got your hardliners. I mean, have you made any progress with the indifference or with the hardliners?
So quite frankly, with the hardliners, no. Right. They're going to continue believing that Cuba is stuck in a Cold War mentality. And you saw that in President Trump's speech on June 16th, that it was basically ghostwritten by Senator Rubio and Congressman Diaz-Balart. And it was evident that the speech was written by people that have never been to Cuba in their lives and never visited.
I've visited Cuba more times than Marco Rubio now.
Right. Which is sad, though, because the new policy isn't reflecting the new Cuba and isn't supporting what it purports to support, which is the Cuban private sector, the folks that you have here. However, I would say that the middle camp, the folks that were indifferent or just were deferring to those louder voices in the room.
Maybe they're on the fence. Yeah.
Yeah. We've made progress with them. I mean, actually, in the last election, we brought on board about 10 members in the House and 4 in the Senate that, you know, folks that were elected that were in favor of engagement. And also one of the things that Engage Cuba has been doing to try to create a counterbalance to those loud voices, the hardliners, is to launch what we call state councils, which is a cluster of local leaders in mostly red states like Alabama, Tennessee, Ohio, Iowa, and for those constituents to get back to their members of Congress and explain why they are in favor of lifting the embargo, whether that's from rice farmers in Louisiana that want to be able to freely export their product or manufacturers in Ohio. But doing those kind of local efforts, localizing the issue, I think has been really successful in bringing more members of Congress on board with a policy of engagement.
Yeah, and I think misconceptions play a big role here. I didn't fully know what to expect when going to Cuba. I feel like everyone has an idea in their head and then it's not exactly what they expected. Some things maybe, but some things not. What I saw was a population that is remarkably well-informed, well-educated, not bitter about some of the things that we might perceive as, you know, terrible that the government does, and clamoring for more internet, clamoring for engagement, clamoring for more visitors, no anti-Americanism, actually the opposite. I was treated so well, better than I'm often treated in New York City where I grew up. Everyone was super nice. We talked about baseball. There's so many shared interests, the entertainment industry. Everyone knows all the same actors and actresses that Americans watch. So it's not, yeah, and right. And it's not North Korea, right? We're not dealing with a bunch of people who bow down to a photo of Fidel Castro every day and thank him for all of the great things he does. It's not a brainwashed population. This is just, it's not what you would expect. It's complicated. And that's the one thing that I heard over and over again when we asked questions of Cubans. We just heard, es complicado.
People are very happy because they see that things are going to happen faster. But we as entrepreneurs, we are very concerned about the new policies of President Trump because of if they stop the trip for Americans to Cuba, it would affect directly to us than any other, more than the government, more than the military enterprise, the government, more than anyone. The more affected business in Cuba will be the entrepreneurs, the cuenta propistas, the private sector will be the more affected. I knew it from before, but many Cubans at the beginning of the relation, they were afraid because we thought when we was a kid, Americans, they are bad, they make war, they, you know, but it's the same idea that you have from Cuba.
Right.
It's not the same. This is just a movie. This is a dream. The real life is that Cubans are open for Americans, and we would like to Americans will be open for Cuban as well.
Yeah, that's a powerful message. And would you like to add anything, Celia?
Yes, I would like to add that if by any chance there is one of those hardliners or people that know any of them, I would like to invite them to come to Cuba. If they're worried that they're going to give their money away to the government, they can use Concierge Havana, that they're going to eat at Paladars. They're going to ride in private taxis. They're going to stay at Casa Particulares owned by Cuban people. And they're going to, and I would like for them to actually come and experience it on themselves before they take on a policy that they don't know that they're actually going to harm us. The way they're expressing themselves and banning people to people is going to actually damage us instead of helping us. So I think before taking a life decision that is going to affect us by doing this policy, I think the first they should come to Cuba and meet us and see what you were able to experience and what changed your mind.
Yeah. And I'll just say anecdotally, I spent most of my money in the private sector down there. I will admit that I brought back some Havana 7 that I bought at a hotel, and it's delicious. But I dropped lots of cash in these restaurants, probably more than I should have because I had maybe one too many mojitos. But I was happy to do it because I knew that it was helping people. And that's a major concern, I think, for Americans, that they want to make sure that the money's going into the hands of the Cuban people. And under the current policy, you are absolutely able to do that. Michael, any thoughts before we close off?
So part of this June 16th Trump speech talks about empowering the Cuban people. And the next step is for the departments of Treasury, Commerce, and State to actually write the regulations. And that's in part why Celia, Robin, and six of their colleagues are here to inform those regulatory agencies so that hopefully the regulations that are written do in fact empower them, as opposed to just sow confusion on whether or not it's legal to go to Cuba. Because ultimately, that confusion will lead to a reduction in American visitors, and that will disadvantage the Cuban private sector.
Yeah, and according to the embassy, we heard that 80% of Americans are spending their money in the private sector. So it's extremely important that that continue if we want to grow the private sector. And if you're hell-bent on regime change, I got a message for you. It's not going to happen, right? If you think that the Cuban people want to take up arms against their government, I saw none of that, and the statistics back it up. If you want a real theory of change, something that might actually be possible, it's the middle class. It's people growing their wallets. It's people growing their businesses. And when that constituency is so large and powerful in Cuba that the government can't possibly ignore them, maybe you will have political freedom. But if our government continues to insist on a Cold War mentality, trying the same failed policy for over 60 years, that's not going to work. So there's my message to close off the show. But my guests have been Celia Mendoza, founder of Concierge Havana, an agency that does itineraries for Americans coming to Cuba. Please, if you are thinking of a trip, especially before the policy changes, go to her website or her social media pages and check that out. And if you want to read more about culture and entertainment in Cuba, check out VStar, which was founded by Robin Pedraja. Thank you so much for joining the show, Robin.
VStarMagazine.com.
There you go. It's got a website. And Michael, thanks for bringing all these fine folks to America, and thanks for bringing me to Cuba. I really appreciate what you're doing.
And thank you.
And Tech Freedom is a proud member of Engage Cuba, and we will continue to work towards improving relations. But Michael, thanks again. That's it for today. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Tech Freedom. We'll be posting photos that we take with some of these awesome entrepreneurs, including the founder of Ala Mesa, which is a Yelp-like app in Cuba. Find this podcast in the iTunes store. Please write a review because it will help others find the show. And if you ever want to be a guest on the podcast or have ideas about how we can improve, send us an email at media@techfreedom.org. We'd love to have your feedback. See you next time.
The Tech Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.